Okay, good morning, everyone. Today, Be'ezras Hashem, we're going to be talking about the question of under what conditions can we deviate from the literal understanding of the psukim, what conditions are necessary to justify an allegorical understanding of the psukim. This is a very important question that is frequently asked this time of year, especially around Parshas Bereishis, Parshas Noach. Many people are troubled by seeming problems that arise from the study of science and wonder to what extent do we have to take the psukim literally. But of course, it's not limited to these parshios. It's a general question. We're not going to answer the question today. Namely, answer is Sefer Bereishis or Parshas Bereishis, Parshas Noach, literal, allegorical, or the like. But instead, what I hope to do is look at some of the Rishonim and see the tools that they give us as to how to address this question. And we'll also focus a little bit on the Mahalach of Rambam in Parshas Bereishis. If we have time, also Ramban. So the Gemara already notes that there are times that the Gemara, that the Psukim use hyperbole. Take a look at page 26 in your source books. Amar Rav Ami, Dibra Torah, this is a Gemara in Chulin, Sadi Amud Beis, Dibra Torah, Lashon Havai. The Torah sometimes speaks in hyperbole or exaggerated language. Dibru Nevi'im Lashon Havai, likewise we find this in, among Nevi'im, and Dibru Chacham Lashon Havai. And what's the example in the Torah, Dibra Torah Lashon Havai, the pasuk you have over here that says, Shema Yisrael, Ata Over Hayom, Es Hayarden, Lavo Lareshes, Goyim Gdolim, Vatsumim, Mimeka, Arim Gdolos, Uvitsuros, Pashamayim. Sounds like the pasuk, if we translate it literally, is saying that the cities in the land of Canaan were fortified up to heaven. This is not true. They were very strong, powerful cities with strong walls, but certainly not ad vashamayim. Rather, this is Lashon Havai. Another example of a not... Okay, that is a good point. That's potentially a distinction. It is potentially a distinction. This is the Lashon of Moshe talking to Bnei Yisrael, but nevertheless, it's in the Torah. Another example, the Gemara in Bava Basra on Tezayin Amud Beis talks about Sefer Iyov, and there is one opinion over there that Iyov was Lohaya Velo Nivra, and he, even though when you look at the psukim, it sounds like he was a real person that lived in a real place. He lived in Eretz Uz. It tells us when where he lived. It gives us details about the place that he lives. And nevertheless, the Gemara says, at least according to one opinion, Lo haya velo nivra. Now, that's not to say that there aren't implications in a text that in itself that perhaps it's a mashal, not just the theological problems, but also textual hints. But nevertheless, again, we see the Gemara is willing to consider at least the possibility of a story that is not stated as a mashal of actually being a mashal. So the question again that we're going to deal with today is what parameters justify this deviation from the literal reading, and we're going to begin with the view of Rav Sadia Gaon. You could see this towards the bottom of page 26 from Emunos Videos. The context over here is the following question. How do we know that the psukim that are describing Tchias HaMesim, like the psukim in Daniel, Perek Yud Beis, and Yeshayahu, Perek Chavav, are meant literally? Perhaps the psukim that described Tchias HaMesim were meant allegorically. And the Rav Sadia Gaon notes, just like I will tell you that psukim that describe or imply that God is a physical body are not meant to be taken literally, so perhaps the psukim describing Tchias HaMesim are also not meant to be taken literally. And Rav Sadia Gaon over here considers and then rejects four possible avenues that might lead to a rejection of the literal reading in this case. So to summarize first, he says, maybe you'll say it shouldn't be taken literally for scientific reasons. No, that's wrong. Maybe it shouldn't be taken literally for philosophical reasons. No, that's wrong. Maybe for scriptural reasons, meaning to say it contradicts other psukim. No. Maybe for Mesorah. No. So basically, in the process of his discussion, which we'll read a little bit in a minute, you see that Rasad Yagon is saying that there are four justifications to deviate from literalism. Again, either scientific, philosophical, scriptural, or tradition. And Rasad Yagon rejects all four, not rejects. He shows how all four of these aren't relevant with respect to Tchias HaMeisim. So take a look. We'll read where it's bolded on page 27. V'iyanti umatzasi shamotzim asher yalu tchila b'rishon asher yatu mehem moshchei hataina al zeh arba ein lahem chamishi v'isi kol shibu sheshamati o chashavti bo shiataina al ha'emuna hazos, the emuna meaning of Tchias HaMeisim, v'amadati al Shever hakol ubitulo vefsedo vaz hiskaimo ha'emun azos birayos min ashlosha ha'inyanim asher mehem yimshechu ha'maminim rayosam v'amotim arba asher chakarti alayhem liros hayeshlam emuna hazos bahem tshuva heimotze hateva, like we said, science or experience, v'asechel, philosophy, v'akasov, and based off of other psukim, v'akabalim, based off of Mesorah. So he says, I'm going to establish Tchias HaMeisim basically based off of the three things, Svara, Mikra, and Kabbalah, and I'm going to show how the four reasons that would be a justification for the deviation from literalism are all not relevant here. So let's begin. V'achilosi min ha'teva. So we'll begin with the question of teva, science, or maybe experience. And mipnei shekidamto kedima atzmus. Damarti ula yischayev himana ha'hoda'a b'tchias HaMeisim mipnei himana ha'teva la'asozeh. Maybe you'll say that we shouldn't read the psukim about Tchias HaMeisim literally because it's scientifically impossible. Mipnei she'ein kemo shegdolim bale chayim b'teva. Right? In the scientific realm, we never find anybody coming back alive after they've died. Amiyachdim, shemaminim shabore mishana minhagia teva, v'yasimim b'chol eis shiyirtze kasher yirtze, i'efshar lahem lihimana mehodos b'tchias HaMeisim mitzad teva. Very simple. He says that the only reason to reject Tchias HaMeisim based off of science is if you deny the possibility of a miracle. Why would anyone deny the possibility of a miracle? He says this is something that emerges from the Aristotelian perspective on the universe, like we talked about before, the idea of kadmas ha'olam, the eternality of matter. But once you deny that, you believe that there was bria yesh me'ayin, and you believe that nisim are possible, and surely the rest of the Torah tells us that nisim are possible, so then there would be no reason to doubt that the psukim that describe Tchias HaMeisim are not meant literally based off of scientific evidence. So when would we consider understanding a pasuk non-literally based off of science? So Rav Sadia Gaon gives an example from Parshas Bereishis. It says about Chava, she was Em Kol Chai. Now, this is contradicted by experience because we don't find that human beings, that women give birth to other species other than humans. So Therefore, we shouldn't take Em Kol Chai literally, that she was the mother of all living beings. Rather, it means all human life, that Chava was the source for all humans that would emerge subsequently. Now, here you have to ask an obvious question, which is, if he's saying that we believe in Tchias HaMesim because we believe in Nisim, so maybe Chava was Em Kol Chai, and it was a nace. There was a nace, that Chava gave birth to the lion, and Chava gave birth to the elephant, right? Maishna, the nace of Tchias HaMesim, from the nace of saying Em Kol Chai, is also literally, is understood literal. So I think the answer is pretty straightforward, which is that when you look at the psukim that describe Tchias HaMesim, the implication is that this is an extraordinary thing. This is a nace. And therefore, the only reason to say that it's not literal based off of scientific reasons is to say that Hashem can't do a nace. Whereas the psukim that describe Chava being Em Kol Chai don't imply that this was some type of extraordinary act or a miracle. And therefore, there is reason based off of science or experience to assume that the pasuk Em Kol Chai is not meant to be taken literally. Meaning to say, when we want to understand whether or not you should understand a pasuk literally, and especially in consideration of scientific evidence, you have to go ahead and study the pshat and figure out, is the implication here that this is extraordinary or not? Just to give another example where we might find a similar application of this idea, there's a famous Ibn Ezra who says that even though Chazal say that Yocheved was born Bein HaChomos, because if you count the number of people that are listed when the Jewish people went down to Mitzrayim at the end of Sefer Bereishis, it says that there were 70, you could only count 69, it must be Yocheved was born Bein HaChomos. So the Ibn Ezra says this is not what actually happened, because that would make Yocheved 130 years old when Moshe was born, right? Because the Jews were in Egypt for 210 years. Moshe was 80 when they left, so she would have been 130 when they were born. Now, Ibn Ezra is not denying the possibility of a miracle, but he makes the following point. He says, look, when Sarah Imenu gave birth at the age of 90, look at the big deal that the Torah made of such a miraculous event. So if there was an even greater miracle, a woman giving birth at the age of 130, so then the Torah would have said something. Look at this extraordinary miracle. The fact that it didn't tells us that there wasn't a miracle. In other words, he's looking to the psukim and saying the psukim will or should inform us when something miraculous takes place. Now, others, among them the Ramban over there, disagree with him. And first of all, Ramban says that the miracle by Sarah was because it was predicted in advance, and moreover, because she had never had children beforehand, and so on and so forth. So not everybody accepts Ramban over there. And you'll find in general that there are different approaches among the Rishonim how far to take science when trying to understand the meaning of psukim. One of the most famous problematic examples is the Shita of Ralbag, who tells us that Shemesh begivon dom, and likewise in the case of Chizkiah, cannot mean what the psukim literally sound like because of his Aristotelian conception of the universe and the possibility of miracles only being in the sublunar world, without getting into the details. And others, like the Rivash and the Maral, critique that point. They say, no, the psukim imply that there was a miracle b'shemesh b'givon donim. It must be that the sun actually did stop, like the psukim say. So there will be cases, whether it's the Machlokes that we mentioned, Ibn Ezra and Ramban, or Ralbag, Rivash, or the like, where there might be a disagreement. But the basic point, I think, probably, that the basic point of Sadia Yagon here is probably accepted, namely the idea that miracles are possible, and sometimes the question is, should we assume that the psukim in a particular place are talking about a miracle, or perhaps are talking in a non-literal way, because the implication of the psukim is not that there's necessarily a miracle in this particular instance. Yes?
I mean, but the, that being Baha'i, for example, is only, it's not, there's only so much diversion from the Pshat and the Pasuk.
Correct. It's not like, correct. So that's also a factor. In other words, how dochak is the non-literal read.
No, but
so Eim Kol Chai is very much not dochak, because it really, you know, when I first read it, I didn't even know why he thought like Eim Kol Chai was a deviation from literalism.
Right.
Eim Kol Chai, of course that means humans. But he's saying, no, if we actually translate it literally, it says Kol Chai, not Kol B'nei Adam. Right? So, therefore, Rav Sadia Gaon sees that as an example of a deviation from the literal reading based off of Teva. Now, you're absolutely correct that that's a deviation that's not dochak in any way. None of us would be troubled by that deviation. That's very different than, let's say, Ralbag's reading of Shemesh B'Givon Dom. I fully agree. So that, too, is a factor. In other words, that's what I was saying before, that looking to the pshat of the psukim is very much going to play a role in determining whether or not there's grounds for deviating from the literal read.
Yeah, and also just to put it in terms of what we said before, Lashon Avad, all we're saying here is that the deviation means that the pasuk is in Lashon Avad. It doesn't mean it's allegory.
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely correct. Meaning to say, and we'll return to this point shortly, that there's a big difference between saying something is a mashal versus saying something is Lashon Havai or the like. Absolutely. Right now, Rav Sadia Gaon is putting everything together in terms of deviating from the literal reading, but there are various ways of deviating, and surely that makes a big difference. Absolutely. Okay. So the next example that Rav Sadia Gaon has is logic. So skip a little bit to the next paragraph. Bacharken chakarti b'motzei sheni asher hu hamechashev b'seichel v'darashti im emtza l'amunah zos mashi v'telos. Is there anything in Tchias HaMesim that would contradict logic? V'lo matasi ma she misapek ba kiim shlosha drachim achas ma she tia yecholas al Tchias HaMesim in hasheker v'kvar amadati al sheinena kein kasher biarti. Why would you think it's logically impossible? Because you think it's scientifically impossible? We already addressed that. We believe in miracles. Vashenis shiyah hayachol al ze lo hivtichan bo umatzasi shivtiach bo mekomos rabim in amikra. And Hashem promised it would happen. And so on and so forth. So what's an example of a case where we deviate from the literal reading based off of logic? So Rav Sadia Gaon's example for that is the pasuk in Parshas and Sefer Dvarim, Dalad Chav Dalad, where it refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Esh Ochlahu. God is a consuming fire. So that could be logically disproven, because fire is a physical substance, and it could be proven that God is non-physical. Rav Sadia Gaon, like the Rambam, shows how this could be logically proven. And therefore, to read the Pasuk literally, that Hashem is an Esh Ochla, would contradict logic, and therefore we're forced to understand that the pasuk is referring to God's vengeance and not literally that he is a consuming fire. And then he notes also that there are actually psukim that support this type of reading. He quotes a pasuk from Tzfanya that shows that Eish is referring to, often is referred to by or compared to, fire as well. Now, we should note here as well that the Rav Sadia Gaon is not saying that all types of philosophical speculation justify deviation from the literal reading. Rav Sadia Gaon did very much believe in the koach of seichel, we should note. Sadia Gaon, throughout his sefer, says that truths that we know of from three sources generally, from psukim, from Kabbalah, from tradition, as well as from seichel. So seichel is certainly an important tool to come to an understanding of the truth, but when it comes to the level of certainty that justifies the deviation from the literal, so at least in Rav Sadia Gaon's example over here, He thinks that it's not just a svara that it's going against, but it's something that could be logically proven. Since it could be logically proven that God has no physical body, so therefore the deviation from the literal reading is logical. Again, how far you go in this question is sometimes the subject of dispute, like that example of the machlokas between the Rivash and the Ralbag about Shemesh B'Givon Dom. Okay, the third reason that he gives us is based off of textual reasons. V'achar kach chakarti, again page 27, b'motze hashlishi, hua kasuv b'mikra, v'istakalti ula yesh ba, ma shemoneh tchias ha-meisim b'olam hazeh. In other words, maybe there are psukim that go ahead and indicate that the psukim that describe tchias ha-meisim shouldn't be taken literally. U'matzasi sfeiko she'efshar she'nitlin ba ha-marchikim es zeh, v'arisi she'zachrem hinei u'levatlam. Mehem v'yizkor basar hema ruach olech v'lo yashuv, v'lo od ela enosh kechatzir yamav, or Ketzitz Yatza V'Yamal V'Gomer. So there are psukim that people have cited that might indicate that Tchias HaMeisim is impossible because once you die, you're finished. And he shows that that's an incorrect reading of the psukim. So the Ralbag says, though, that there are cases where, based off of psukim, we won't translate a pasuk literally. So the example he gives is in Dvarim, we say, Lo Tinasunas Hashem Elokeichem, you shouldn't test God. This contradicts the pasuk in Malachi that uvechanuni gam bazos, that you are allowed to trust Hashem when it comes to giving maestros, that Hashem will reimburse you. And he cites the Gemara that resolves the stira by distinguishing between testing God in the realm of charity versus testing Hashem in other areas. This type of resolution, of course, is ubiquitous in Gemara, as we mentioned last week. And sometimes we resolve this stira by saying the pasuk isn't meant literally, and sometimes we use other midot shatara nidreshes bahen in order to resolve the contradiction. And Rav Sadia Gaon over here writes that it's clear, though, that there's no justification for doing this in the case of Tchias HaMeisim. And finally, the fourth cause, Misora, Vacharkein lo nimnati mechakor b'motzei ha-revi'i, hu asher ha'atakta ha-nevi'im v'kabalas chachamim, amarti ulai emtza bo tshuva al tchias ha-meisim. And of course the answer is no. Adarabba, when we look at the Misora, that supports the idea of there being a literal tchias ha-meisim. So there's nothing in the Misora that contradicts it. But there are times, based off of the Misora, that we don't read a pasuk literally. The example that Rav Sadia Gaon gives is the halacha l'Moshe Misinai, that you only get 39 makos. So even though the psukim say 40, arba'im yakenu, we understand that means 39. And we read the psukim non-literally based off of the Misora. Now, this raises another issue which perhaps we will return to, but we won't discuss today, which is that when you have a Misora that tells us to read a pasuk differently than the simple understanding of the psukim, does the Misora mean to say that's the pshat? Or no, the pshat is still the pshat, and the drash, or the Misora, is another or a different level of interpretation. In other words, there's no doubt that halach lemaisa, you get 39 makos, is that the pshat in a pasuk? Or there's no doubt that halach lemaisa, on a halachic level, we don't take ayin tachas ayin literally, and we deviate from the simple understanding there based off of Misora, that ayin tachas ayin is mamon. The Gemara also shows perhaps there are textual grounds for that deviation, but primarily the Rambam says it's based off of Misora, ayin tachas ayin is non-literal, it means mamon. Does that mean that that's just the drash, or is that also the pshat of the pasuk? What difference does that question make anyway? The question perhaps we'll return to another time. But one way or the other, Rav Sadia Gaon says certainly Misora is a reason on some level to deviate from the literal reading of the psukim. So we accept that, we reject the literal reading of ayin tachas ayin in favor of the Mesorah that it's a reference to Mammon. Okay, so those are Rosh Yagon's four reasons to deviate from the literal reading of the Psukim. Like Rosh Yagon, turning now to the Rambam, on page 28, so the Rambam also says that you need justification to deviate from literalism. I'll just read you a translation of what he writes here in his famous essay on Trias HaMesim. I believe every possible happening that is supported by a prophetic statement and do not strip it of its plain meaning. Right? As you know, there were those who claimed that Rambam didn't really believe in Trias HaMesim. He responded in his Igeres Trias HaMesim, and he says, no, the Psukim say there will be Trias HaMesim, and like Rosh Yagon before him, I'm not going to strip those Psukim of their literal meaning. And he writes later, what grounds call for a deviation from literalism? He writes, I fall back on interpreting a statement non-literally only when its plain meaning is impossible, like the corporeality of God. The possible, however, remains as stated. So like Rosh Yagon, Rambam writes that we understand Psukim literally unless we're forced to understand them non-literally. When it comes to God's corporeality, we're forced to understand it non-literally. It could be proven, demonstrated philosophically that God has no body, so therefore the non-literal interpretation is justified. Where there is no justification, then we do not do so. So along, more or less, the Rambam seems to be accepting Rosh Yagon's basic premise, which is that we have to understand things literally unless there is a good reason to understand them non-literally. The Rambam, in a very famous passage that we quoted last week, we'll return to it now, discusses in his introduction to Morah Nevuchim the use of figurative language in the Sefer Bereishis, or Parshas Bereishis, the use of parables, riddles, and obscure words. So take a look, page 28. Therefore, the Almighty commenced the Torah with a description of Briyas HaOlam, because it's very important, but also people can't understand it. He describes those profound truths, which divine wisdom found it necessary to communicate to us in allegorical, figurative, and metaphorical language. That translation, as you see in the footnote, is from the Friedlander version. If you look at the Kappach version or the Schwartz version quoted in footnote 32 on page 28, you'll see they use the words mashalim, chidos, and dvarim stumim meod. So there are mashalim and chidos in Parshas Bereishis. Our sages have said it is impossible to give a full account of creation to man. Therefore, the Torah is basically mekatzer. Thus, they have suggested that the subject is a deep mystery, in the words of Shlomo, far off and exceedingly deep. Who can find it out? It has been treated in metaphors, or mashalim, in order that the uneducated may comprehend it according to the measure of their faculties and the feebleness of their apprehension, while educated persons may take it in a different sense. So what exactly is he talking about over here? So the Rambam, when describing Bereishis, does give us a number of examples. He really works through the Psukim. So first of all, in 229 in the guide, he writes, not everything mentioned in the Torah concerning Maaseh Bereishis is to be taken in its external sense as the vulgar imagine. Sorry, you don't have that here. So he says clearly not everything about Maaseh Bereishis is to be taken in its external sense. So clearly there are many things in Maaseh Bereishis that are meant to be taken in their external sense. What is and what isn't. So the Rambam doesn't tell us, but I'll give you a couple of examples from his Parshanut in Perek Aleph of Bereishis. So he says, for example, the word Eretz in Pasuk Aleph, Bereishis Bara Elokim Es HaShemayim Ves HaAretz, is different than the word Aretz in Pasuk Aleph, Pasuk Yud. Now, why is that? Because whenever he gives us a rule, whenever the Torah says in Parak Aleph, and God called A, B, so that indicates that B is an equivalent term, and therefore in the second appearance in the text, it is a different meaning than in the first appearance of, in the text. So when it says that he called dry land Eretz, so that meaning of the word Eretz is different than the first meaning of the word Eretz, Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz, right? Likewise for Shamayim. When it says, and he called the Rakia Shamayim, so that clearly, the Rambam says, has a different meaning than the first time Shamayim is used, right? Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz. So what does it mean? So he says, for example, the second occurrence of Eretz, because it says he called the dry land Eretz, so it has a different meaning. There, Eretz means the dirt, whereas the first time Eretz means the four elements. In other words, the things that all physical substances would emerge from. And likewise, the same thing when it comes to Shamayim. Shamayim can mean heaven, Shamayim could mean sky, right? And you see the psukim themselves go ahead and allude to this point because it says Vayikra Elokim X, Y, differently than clearly the way it was meant in the first pasuk. So one thing is clear, which is that the Rambam's tools for interpretation of the first parak are systematic, they're rooted in a text. He's not just saying, oh, you know, let's turn the whole thing into some big mashal for whatever we want to say that it means. He goes through the psukim very carefully, and he justifies his interpretations in light of the psukim. Sometimes he does the same thing for the growth of the trees and the grass on the third day, there in order to resolve the seeming contradiction between the narrative in Parak Aleph and the narrative in Parak Beis, right? So he goes ahead and he says, yeah, you can't translate every word literally, but there's a basis for the variations in translations. Now sometimes, for example, when describing Rakia, that's an example that I don't think you really, Eretz, that you really have to work to saying riddles and parables and the like. Rakia, so he goes a little further. When defining Rakia, he writes, but there is something hidden, as you will see, with regard to the firmament and the thing above it, which is called water. If, on the other hand, the matter is considered according to its inner meaning and to what is truly intended, it is most hidden. For in that case, it was necessary for it to be one of the concealed secrets so that the vulgar should not know it. So he says we can't translate Rakia. There's a secret going on with the word Rakia, right? What's the secret? So if you look at the Abarbanel in his Perush on the Mor Nevuchim, he writes that the masses understood that the firmament was something rigid with water above it and below it, and a literal reading of the text might imply that there is this rigid Rakia, and that corresponds to the view of the masses, but it's not the true intent of the text. Basically, again, if you read the Mor Nevuchim carefully, I think he says basically there are two meanings of the word Rakia. The first signifies heavens, and the second is one of the strata of air in the sublunar world. So the Rambam, you know, very carefully goes through much of Parak Aleph of Bereishis. He tells you what the words mean. And again, they're very much rooted in the text. Now, what about the question of creation in general? Let me just talk about it more generally, and then I'll take your questions. What? One is that it's something that is that it's in the heavens, right? And the second is it's one of the strata, in other words, in the sublunar world, there are various sort of spheres or strata levels of the sky, and Rakia is one of them, right? Those are two very different things. Below the moon, meaning in the spheres below the moon. Imagine concentric circles, right, surrounding the world. So sublunar means the one of them which is below the world, what we would call the atmosphere, right? So in one place, Rakia means atmosphere, and the other place, it means heavens. Two different things. The Rambam... More spiritual, definitely more spiritual. Okay. So what about the more general point? So here we're going to read the very famous, controversial passage from Mar Nevuchim. Just a little bit of background. The Rambam writes that one of the goals of Mar Nevuchim is to show how Torah doesn't contradict philosophy. One of the main goals is certainly to show that their, you know, correct interpretation of the Torah does not support the corporeality of the Ribono Shel Olam. And for dozens of chapters in Chelek Aleph of Mar Nevuchim, he goes through word after word, shows what these words really mean. Sometimes words have multiple meanings. He quotes examples of each of the multiple meanings and shows what they mean in each place, such that you could read the Psukim in a way that does not indicate corporeality. Now, what about when it comes to Bereshis and the story of creation? So as we mentioned before, Aristotle's position was there was no creation, the eternity of matter. And the Rambam writes that the reason why I reject Aristotle's reading is not because of textual issues. After all, the psukim that indicate that there was Bria Yesh Me'ayin are not more numerous than the psukim that imply God has a physical body. And yet I'm willing to understand those psukim that imply God has a physical body in a way that does not support that notion. Rather, there are two reasons why I rejected Aristotle. But it's not because of the psukim, right? So why did I reject Aristotle? It's not based on the psukim. You'll tell me, what do you mean the Pesukim say? Gracious bar alokim? No. If it could be, well, we'll see what he says in a moment. One of the things he says, if you could really prove that Aristotle was right, so we'd figure out a way to read the Pesukim. We could read, you know, just look at Rashi and Gracious parak aleph pasuk aleph. Right? The way he reads the Pesukim doesn't mean gracious bar alokim, in the beginning God created. It means in the beginning of God's creation. So, I'm not saying that that might also imply Yesh Me'ayin or not. Interesting question. But the point is, it's not just coming from the Psukim. So let's read it together. Da, page 28. Da, ki Beirachnu milizbor kadmas ha'olam machmas ha'kosav asher nomar betor sha'olam mechudash lefi she'en ha'ksuvim amorim al chidu sha'olam yoser min ha'ksuvim amorim al Heyos ha'aloha guf. Right? The psukim that say that there was bria are no more numerous than the psukim that indicate that God has a body. V'gam ein darkei abir ne'alamim b'faneinu v'lo nimna'im mimenu b'inyan chidush ha'olam. The ways of interpretation are not closed to us, meaning to say that we are able to understand psukim in such a way, interpret psukim in a way that gives us flexibility to some degree. So that's not the reason. Elo yicholim ayinu leva'ero sam kederach she'asinu b'shlilas hagashmos, page 29. We could have understood them in ways like we did to solve the problem of corporeality. V'yitachen shezaya yoser kal beharbeh. Actually, it would have been easier to read the psukim in Parshas Bereishis in a way that conforms with Aristotle's theory on the eternity of matter. That would have been an easier task than it was to go ahead and read the psukim that imply his gashmas. V'itachen, sorry, v'haysal anu yecholas rabba l'va'er osam haksuvim v'nikiyim kadmus ha'olam nikayim kadmus ha'olam kederach shebi'arnu haksuvim. So, if the reason was not based off of the psukim, the reason why I reject the eternity of matter and accept creation is not based off the psukim, then what is the reason? V'asher hevi osanu shelo nase kein, v'lo nizbor kein, hem shtei sibos, two reasons. Ha'achas, ki ze she'en halo kaguf, huchach, v'chova bechleit leva'er, kol ma she Pashto neged ha'hochacha v'vadash yesh lo bi'ur bechleit v'kadmas ha'olam lo hochacha v'lachein ein ra'ui l'dchos es ha'ksuvim u'l'v'aram l'ma'an hachras hashkafa
asher efshar lachriya hafcha besugei hachra'a rabim zuhi sibachas. Number one, the incorporeality of God has been proven. Since it has been proven, so therefore, we interpret the psukim that imply otherwise in a way that conforms with that which has been proven. Ma she'en kein, the eternity of matter has not been proven. In fact, the Rambam writes that he rebuffs the various arguments that Aristotle brings in support of the eternity of matter. Maybe in a moment I'll tell you what some of them are. But not only that, but he says, adirabba, the idea of bria, of creation ex nihilo, is actually the more compelling perspective from the viewpoint of science. Now, the Rambam acknowledges that you can't prove bria yesh me'ayin in a definitive way, in a syllogistic way, meaning to say, unlike God's existence or his incorporeality, bria cannot be proven. But nevertheless, it's the more reasonable explanation from a scientific standpoint. And even besides that, it's certainly not the case that the eternity of matter has been proven. And therefore, since the eternity of matter has not been proven, we have no reason to deviate from the simple reading of the text. So again, like Rasad Yagon, Rambam saying to deviate from simple reading of the text, from the literal reading of the text based off of scientific or philosophic rationales has to be ironclad. And if it's not ironclad, then that's not justified. And certainly in the case of Abriyas Olam, where the Rambam actually thinks he has support for the opinion. Nowadays, we'll say actually it's, you know, the Aristotelian model has more or less been rejected. Sort of come back fashionable a little bit recently with the idea of a multiverse, but that's totally speculative. So the idea of matter being eternal has been rejected scientifically. The idea of there being a beginning, whatever you call it, the Big Bang or the like, is the accepted model. And the Rambam says the same thing. But again, point number one is that it hasn't been proven. Point number two, okay, Vasiba Shnia, ki svarasenu she'en ha'aloka guf, eno soser lanu mi'uma mi'isodo satora. There is more to the Torah than simply Perek Aleph of Sefer Bereishis. Perek Aleph of Sefer Bereishis, so maybe you could read in a way that doesn't contradict Aristotle. But Yesodos HaTorah certainly do contradict Aristotle. Now, the reason for this is complex. I don't think we should explain it today. But if you accept Aristotle's perspective, then there is no room for things like Nevuah or Nisim or the like. And it's clear from the Torah that there is Nevuah and there are Nisim. There's no way you could read the Torah in a way that there's no Nevuah, there's no Nisim. That would be a joke. Right? So while perhaps we could explain Perek Aleph of Bereishis in a way that wouldn't contradict Aristotle, we definitely cannot explain Chamisha Chumshei Torah in a way that would not contradict Aristotle. And that is the second reason we reject Aristotle. The first reason, to summarize, is that there's no scientific proof. The second reason is it's against the Torah. And if Aristotle is against the Torah, so we accept the Torah over Aristotle. When it comes to the corporeality of God, so no, you could read the psukim in a way that doesn't imply corporeality, and therefore it's not Torah against philosophy, because there's not a stira. But in this case, there is a stira between Torah and philosophy, and that, therefore, is the second reason why we reject Aristotle. He then differentiates between Plato and Aristotle. Both Plato and Aristotle did believe in the eternity of the universe, but Plato's conception of the eternity would conceivably allow for things like miracles, right? Plato understood that there was an imposition of form on pre-existing matter, as opposed to Aristotle, where the eternity of matter or eternal emanations, things were always like this. So if you took Plato's Mahalich, there would be no Bria Sa'olam, but the possibility of Nisim and Nevuah do exist. So therefore, he says, I reject Plato's theory for just the first reason, because it hasn't been proven. And I reject Aristotle's reason, both for the first reason and the second reason. A, it hasn't been proven. B, it's against the Torah. And therefore, it's not, to summarize the textual reasons, it's not Parshas Bereishis that causes me to reject Aristotle, but it's these two reasons instead. And just to skip a little bit, it's late, but you could keep on reading here. The Rambam will just skip to the end, where it's bolded on page 29. right? Aval kevan shelo huchacha lo hashkafa zu no natala velo laosaha hashkafa cheres nifne klal. We won't do Aristotle or Plato. Ela nikach es hamikraos kipshutam. We're going to explain Parshas Bereishis kipshutam. V'nomar haTorah hodia lanu davar asher lo yagia kochenu lehasagaso vanisim idim al amitas tverinu. The idea of Nisim clearly show we're right. There was Bria Yesh Me'ayin. So the Rambam, despite his saying that we use these tools to explain Parshas Bereishis, in the end also says that we're going to explain Parshas Bereishis kipshuto, right? Nikach es hamikraos kipshutam. Now, that's not to say that the Rambam, said a little differently. There are cases where the Rambam is criticized for interpreting the psukim or using philosophy to interpret psukim. One example is from 242, where the Rambam understands that the angels that visited Avram, that the whole event was not something that literally happened. The Rambam thinks that angels cannot take on a human form because they're a spiritual being. So it's not that three angels came and visited Abraham in the more literal sense. Rather, he understands that the whole story took place in a dream.
That's an allegory.
Good. Mm-hmm. Namely, Abraham had a dream that he saw these three angels coming. And the Ramban, famously in Perek Yud Ches of Bereishis, criticizes the Rambam. And you might think that this is a machlokas about, like, philosophy. Rambam thinks you could reread the Pesukim based off of philosophy, and the Ramban says, no, you can't. But again, I think if you read the Rambam and Ramban carefully, that's not really what's going on here. The Rambam, first of all, is not suggesting, as you just pointed out, a non-literal reading. The Rambam's elucidation, you might say it's a little forced, but doesn't say anywhere that any phrases are meant figuratively. The Rambam basically understands that the opening pasuk of Parshas Bereishis is like an introduction to that section, and God appeared to Avram, right? Vayera Hashem el Avram be'elonei mamre, v'hu yoshev pesach ha'ol kachom hayom. So now, what is the nature of this appearance? How did God appear to Avram? It was in a dream. The Rambam understands that Avram's prophecies took place in a dream. And in the dream, v'hinei shlosha malachim, you know, three men came, or angels that looked like men, they came and they told him these things and the like. So the Rambam isn't, and there's no, like you said, nothing, no allegory here. You could say it's dochak, you could say it's not dochak, but it's a understanding of the Pesukim. And when the Ramban, for example, goes ahead and critiques this, he focuses on textual points. Like, if Rambam is right, so when exactly did the dream end, right? It's not at all clear when the dream end, right? Because at some point, reality returns. And the dream is ended. It's not clear from the Pesukim. So you have to figure out, according to the Rambam, where did the dream end? Now, I'm not saying that there's no fundamental dispute here at all, but it's not what... there clearly, in that Ramban, is a machlokas about the nature of prophecy and the nature of malachim, But the Rambam here is not saying, based off of philosophy, there's a wholesale disregard of the psukim. Perhaps there are philosophical motivations for this interpretation, but it's a interpretation that Rambam shows is very much rooted in the text. So, to summarize, it's certainly true that Rambam's philosophical positions color his exegesis, but they're also, you know, what he said, what we mentioned at the beginning, I fall back on interpreting a statement non-literally only when its plain meaning is impossible. The basic point that we saw from Rav Sadia Gaon, so that is something that I think you see throughout the writing of the Rambam. Just when you look at the Rishonim, you will see that the debate about allegorical interpretations of the Torah is one that raged in the time of the Rishonim. It's not just a 20th century debate. This was a major issue. You see the Rishonim talking about it. The Akedas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Arama, goes ahead and he sums up the divergent views in terms of the justification for deviating from the literal understanding. You could see it on page 30, in three groups. So the first group, Hachad, Hakas Hahamonim, Hamekabeles Kol Dvareha Kiksavan, the class of people or interpretations that understands everything literally, the Choshvim Ki Ma'amar, Vayis Atsev Alibo, Vayara Hashem, Vayichar Af Hashem, Erdana Ve'ered, those are literal, and they're wrong. Right, so the first class of people who interpret everything in the Torah literally are making a mistake. So the second group are those who deviate from the literal understanding of the psukim. And he says that this group falls into two different classes. The first group, Amehem, Anshei Das, V'yiras Hashem, Shiyakablu Hamishpat Ha'iyuni, Bechol ma shelo teharis pina mipinos haTorah. So they accept mishpat iuni, but in such a way that does not undermine any of the foundations of the Torah. V'yifreshu dvarav beofen shiyaskimu imo, kemo shahaya inyan bechol ma shegazru alav dibra Torah kalashon bnei adam. Right, dibra Torah kalashon bnei adam does mean that we interpret things not in a most literal sense. And that is, among other things, for philosophical reasons. Amnam, b'chol ma she'amishpat ha-sichli neged divrei ha-Torah, hineihem yireyem l'nafsham. But there are times when philosophy contradicts Torah, and then they are fearful. V'hein lo ya'aminu lo, v'lo yishme'u l'kol lo. Aval, Yikaimu divrei haTorah, v'yomru ki katzar haseichel hamasig ha'inyan ha'hu, kemo she'asa harav hamore l'drosh hachidush. But there are times when this first class, we'll call it the 2A, so they are aware that we can't go ahead and just interpret the Torah as we wish. And there are times when Torah might be against philosophy or science. And if that's true, so we accept the Torah. And what about the kasha? What about the kasha from science? So he says, we admit that katzar sichleinu. We don't always have the ability to answer every question. And we don't assume that we're always right, our understanding of the universe is always right, our understanding of philosophy is always right, and it would only be based off of that idea that you would say, oh, well, when the Torah contradicts philosophy, we'll have to sort of reinterpret the Torah in an a problematic way to correspond with science. Later on, he calls this group of people the tsnuim, those who are modest. Why are they modest? Because they recognize the limitations on the human intellect. And then there's class 2b, Amnam Yesh Me'am Azei Panim. So in that first class is the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, where he's referring here to the second reason that the Rambam writes for rejecting Aristotle, right, which is that it contradicts Torah. And the implication is that that anytime science, philosophy contradicts Torah, then we accept Torah. And that's tznius. 2b, Amnam Yesh Mehem Azei Panim She Matilin Divrei Torah Mipnei Hagzeira Ha'iyunis Kemo She'asu Ha'makhishim She'enam Bnei Bris V'gam K'tzas Ha'mispalsim Mibnei Amenu.
So then there are those who go ahead and there are no limitations on basically their willingness to deviate from the simple reading of the text of the Torah in order to correspond to their conclusions based off of science and philosophy and the like. And these people are the opposite of tznuin, because they have so much confidence in their own ability to independently discover the truth that basically they'll interpret the Torah in a way that always corresponds to their conclusion. So instead of looking to the Torah as a source of truth, they come to their conclusions about the truth from other through other means, and they simply recreate the Torah in that image and in a way that corresponds to whatever they think. And this could be done for scientific reasons, for philosophical reasons, for moral reasons. This is certainly something that we continue to see today in all sorts of realms, where things that the Torah is pretty clear about, but for other reasons, you know, the Torah could always be reinterpreted to correspond to whatever is popular at the time. You see many times in every generation, people rereading the Torah to correspond to whatever is fashionable at the time. Generally speaking, it's those interpretations that don't stand the test of time, because what's fashionable philosophically or scientifically or whatever it is frequently changes from generation to generation. And it's not so interesting to read a commentary on a Torah that's based off of outdated science or philosophy or the like. And basically, what we see, the Rambam, Rav Sadia Gaon, Akedas Yitzchak, all these other sources as telling us, is that there has to be a balance. On the one hand, we should use our seichel as a means of arriving at the truth. The seichel does have it's a gift given to us from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to use. Ki me'ashem yiten chachma mipiv das usvuna. The chachma that we have comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the ability to think and to rationally conclude various things. But we also have to do that with humility and recognize the limitations of our seichel as well. And therefore, ultimately, we have to be kafuf to the Torah. And therefore, when it comes to matters of interpretation, there has to be a balance. We don't have time anymore. If you want to see two tshuvas of the Rashba on page 31, relating to this issue of literalism and the Rashba's opposition, again, to those who went too far in terms of deviating from literalism, especially when it comes to mitzvos. This is one of the critiques that was leveled against Philo, you know, even earlier. That's why the Jews probably never studied Philo so much until the modern era. It was kept among the Christians, because even though he was observant, as far as we know, but his allegorical interpretations of mitzvos and the like didn't lend themselves to the Mesorah that we have for this type of for interpretation. Okay. Be'ezras Hashem, we will continue next week with a new sugya.
And we'll, you know, until now, I think the last couple of weeks we focused a lot on Rambam and philosophy and alike. We're going to sort of move, starting next week and in coming weeks, to a different focus. Okay, have a good Shabbat.